Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
In 2020, events have again shone a light on inequalities across the globe, and Australia is not an exception. 20 years on from the reconciliation walks of the year 2000, this nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to the elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
Welcome to Policy Forum Pod, the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. I'm Anna-Greta Hunter. I am a physician, I'm a cardiologist, and I'm the Human Futures Fellow at ANU this year. You may know me from previous podcasts, and I've certainly spent time here in the studio before. I'm here with Professor Sharon Bessel.
Hi, Anna-Greta. It's very exciting to be here for what is going to be a great series of podcasts that we're putting together.
Absolutely. No, I'm really looking forward to it. Perhaps before we're getting started on today's podcast, there's a special message for our listeners.
There is. So for those of you who don't know me, but I think I know a lot of you, I'm Professor of Public Policy here at the Crawford School, and I head the Children's Policy Centre and the Poverty and Inequality Research Centre. But before we start, I wanted to share with you some very sad news that we have had earlier this week. Many of our regular pod listeners will know Mark Zanker, who was one of our Facebook group. He was part of our little pod squad. Mark was so engaged in making comments, in giving us ideas for the pod, and in just being part of our community. Mark sadly passed away earlier this week. He was an incredible person. He was such an advocate for social justice and for social change. And he engaged so much with the pod to try to promote those issues and to make us really think about the kinds of questions that we asked. Mark was an Australian representative on the UN Commission on International Trade Law and the Legal Committee of the International Maritime Organization, and Mark brought that professional expertise and knowledge to the way he engaged with the pod. But he also brought such a caring nature. And the Christmas before last, I remember getting a phone call from Mark just thanking us for the work we did on the pod, wishing me happy Christmas. And that was just Mark's approach of caring about the people around him. We will miss Mark. We know that Mark's family and friends will miss him terribly. We wanted to take this moment to thank Mark for his contributions and to let his family and friends know that we're thinking of them at this really sad time.
Absolutely. I'm joining you very much in that message, Sharon. Thank you very much for that. And I think Mark would have enjoyed this policy series that we've got ahead, and I think we can see inspiration in his commentary for the work that we'd like to put together. So a couple of weeks ago, Sharon, we were in this studio and we were with John Falzon, and we were talking about the budget and what our impression of this federal government's budget was. And we had a range of different topics for discussion on that day. Do you remember what sort of themes we walked away with?
I do. I mean, a conversation with John is always fabulous. And so I remember John's comments on the problems of the neoliberal paradigm and that great comment that John always makes about the deafening silence of those who have been excluded. But we started to talk also about a wellbeing economy and what that might mean. And that took us to some really interesting places.
Absolutely. So I think around that, and on that particular podcast and on many of the ones that you've heard through this forum previously, there is a concern about social justice. There is a concern about caring for society. And that was a dominant theme that emerged, I think, in response to the federal government's budget, which really did not address this. It is time to think differently. And we've got this extraordinary opportunity to rethink and reimagine the role that economic policy can play in Australia. You and I share interest in really interesting problems, and I, with my work as the Human Futures Fellow and work with the Commission for the Human Future, we're thinking about catastrophic and existential risks, the sorts of things that have a major impact on large parts of society. Problems like climate change, problems like environmental degradation, problems like war. And what sort of things would you be like us to address during this series?
So the work that I do, but I guess what occupies most of my waking hours, are issues of poverty, of multidimensional poverty, of inequality, and how we address some of those really wicked problems. And particularly also how we think about the intergenerational injustice that comes from things like poverty, but also comes from things like climate change and environmental degradation. You know, a lot of my work has been with children and trying to understand children's views of some of these really difficult issues. And so, you know, in this context of a global pandemic, how do we think about the future and the kinds of future that we are creating for children today? How do we think about addressing some of these really wicked problems?
I've said too often this year, it's an extraordinary time to be thinking about the human future. And the more that we look at these complex, interdependent, interrelated problems, problems of poverty, problems of justice, problems of food security, of climate change, and of catastrophic sorts of events that we've been faced with over the course of 2020, the more I'm looking for solutions. And so I've been reading a little bit more about economics. Is economics a tool that we can use, do you think, to solve some of these problems?
Well, I think that is the big question, isn't it? And I think probably not. I don't think at the moment any one kind of traditional discipline or any one traditional way of thinking is going to resolve these really deep problems that we have. You know, we need to think much more creatively and imaginatively. We need to think in a utopian way. What is the future that we want to imagine and how do we get there? So, listeners, Anna Greta and I have staged a takeover of Policy Forum Pod. And we're going to be doing over the next, what do you think, Anna Greta, 4 or 5 weeks?
4 or 5 weeks, that sounds good.
We're going to be doing a series on a wellbeing economy, but it's going to be moving beyond the economy and economics to addressing some of these issues that we've just been talking about. What are some of the things that you think we should cover?
Well, I think we should start with economics because I don't know enough about it. And so it would be great to talk with to an economist. And I think we've got an extraordinary one lined up for you today. The other sorts I'd like to talk about health and wellbeing and what it means and whether economics plays a big relationship in our health and wellbeing.
I'm obviously going to want us to talk about poverty and inequality.
Very much looking forward to hearing you speak some more about that. That'd be fantastic.
I think we probably need to have climate change in there.
Should we talk about climate change?
Should we talk about climate emergency?
I think we should talk about climate change. So let's put those three things on the table. But today, perhaps we can start with some economics. Let's understand what the landscape of the economic environment we're in at the moment might be like. What are the sorts of economic principles that are underpinning the economic policy decisions that are being made? And where are the points of movement? Where are the points of weakness? Where are the points where we can really foster some great debate about our economic policy and how we can solve some of these complex problems?
That is an excellent idea. And serendipitously, we have Professor John Quiggin joining us today. John Quiggin is Professor of Economics at the University of Queensland, and he's prominent both as a research economist and as a commentator on the Australian economic policy landscape. So he is the ideal person, Anna Greta, to talk through some of these issues with us. He's a fellow of the Econometric Society and of the Academy of Social Sciences in Australia. He is prolific in his writing on issues from climate change through to employment policy. His latest book is Economics in Two Lessons, Why Markets Work So Well and Why They Can Fail So Badly. So John is the perfect person to come and talk to us about some of these things. And of course, having a Queenslander here the day after the State of Origin and Queensland's win is probably most fitting.
Excellent.
John, welcome. It's wonderful to have you here today.
Good day.
So, John, we're going to ask you to shed some light for us on the kinds of thinking that dominate economics today in Australia, but also globally, and to ask you to talk through with us a whole range of terms that we very commonly hear, but not everyone necessarily understands the meaning of. But I wanted to begin by asking you to explain to us, what are the principles that drive the kinds of economics that dominate policy today, both in Australia and globally?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I think it's useful to distinguish between two sorts of bodies of economics. One is the economics done by academic professional economists like me, in which welfare economics, and just another word for well-being, plays quite a central role. And then what you might call bank economics, the kind of stuff you see on the TV, sometime around the finance news, in which somebody explains why the stock market's going up and why it's going down and says stuff about what they call the economy. And those are two very different things. They both have some influence, of course, on economic policy, but most of the time probably that second group has a more direct influence on policy than does the kind of academic economics, the theory of economics, which people like me work on.
So, John, I think for a lot of our listeners, what they would see most is that second group, what they see on the TV when someone from the Reserve Bank is talking about interest rates, for example, or, you know, the kind of bank economics that you're talking about. So what are the kinds of principles that underpin that thinking?
Well, it's not exactly principled. So it basically, there's a lot of stuff taken for granted, but it's basically concerned with the question, how do we get market activity going along at more or less the right kind of level? So certainly the Reserve Bank would be looking at the question of is the economy, the market economy, got a lot of slack, which means there's high levels of unemployment, or on the contrary, is it growing so rapidly that we're in danger of inflation? The business side of that will be looking at the question of, well, what's happening to corporate profits? Are they sustainable? Is the share market going to be strong or weak? So it's really about managing and supporting that market sector of the economy, which is only a part of economic activity.
So if we just take this a little bit further, so we're talking a little bit about market economics here, and I guess some of the words that we've been hearing a lot of, particularly in the context of the coronavirus pandemic, have been problems with both supply and demand, or maybe the things that we want and the things that we need. Do we need to flesh that out a little bit more to understand some of the principles that are behind our economics?
Well, certainly supply and demand are useful concepts, so obviously people want to consume things. Ultimately, they have to supply something, typically their labour, in return for that. And then on the other side of the equation are particularly firms which employ people, produce stuff. So they have a demand for labour and for other inputs and a supply of stuff they produce. And so those concepts are useful if you're interested, for example, in determining what's going to happen to prices and wages. If the demand for some particular good goes up, we expect to see a higher price for that good, which will then induce more people to produce it.
Oh, no. So that defines economic activity. Is that, if we're trying to define what economic activity is within, for both for economic policy and for market activity, is that largely determined by supply and demand, or can you have economic activity without it?
Well, certainly within that particular sector of the economy, that is the market sector, that's basically what's happening. But you've also got a huge amount of economic activity being undertaken in the public sector where demand and supply work very differently, so schools, hospitals and so forth, and a lot of economic activity taking place within and between households. And so it's what we see in when people talk about the economy is essentially that first bit, what's happening within the market, rather than stuff that's happening outside the market, which is a very important part of economic activity.
Mm. So it strikes me that the market is quite a good place to start if we're going to ask the question about growth and economic growth. Could you explain what economic growth is and why we need it?
I think it's useful to go back to an economy like the 20th century economy, which is because things are a bit different now. So in that economy, you had a bunch of people producing primary products, food crops, minerals, fibres and so forth. Another bunch of people turning those in the manufacturing sector into goods, and then another bunch of people making sure that those goods got delivered to households, and that's transport, wholesale and retail trade. And essentially, if economic growth just means more of all those kinds of things. So either the population grows, in which case there are more people doing all those things, or people get better at doing those things, so that we get more of all of those kinds of things. So that sort of, in that context, growth just means more of everything, more resources being extracted, more stuff going through the, more stuff being manufactured, that stuff then being sold to final consumers. All sorts of stuff happening outside that, most obviously in the environment, and stuff that doesn't really fit into it. In particular, most things to do with information and services don't fit nearly so neatly into that story. So that when we look at what's happening now, what we see is something that doesn't fit nearly so neatly into a concept of growth. Some things are accelerating very rapidly. You know, for example, the computer technology we're using to record this podcast, while other things aren't really growing at all, aren't really changing very much. So growth is a concept which really relies on a particular kind of economy that no longer really exists.
John, you used the term the 20th century economy, and you kind of look back to that, which is very disturbing because it makes me feel rather ancient. But it's so interesting to think about us moving from a 20th century economy into a 21st century economy. And can you characterise for us in a little bit more detail what that 21st century economy is starting to look like? And I guess the second part of that question, is a neoliberal paradigm still dominant, or have we moved into a different paradigm in this century?
So taking the first question, what we see is an economy that's in which probably less than half of people's jobs can be thought of as basically tied up with this business of producing goods and delivering them to households. And the other half are involved in services, and an increasingly large share of those in information. And information doesn't fit into this picture very well. You can't hold it. You can't pick it up. If you look at a lot of nostalgic talk about the 20th century economy, they say, yeah, I want something I can drop on my foot. And pretty clearly a podcast isn't something like that, for example. So, and it has information has the characteristic, what economists call a public good, that more information for me doesn't mean less information for you. And that's obviously very different from physical goods. If I have a loaf of bread, you can't have that loaf of bread. So that's, I think, the developing feature of the economy, and particularly notable in the market economy, that nearly all the most valuable firms in the economy now are associated with that information sector, whereas even 10 or 20 years ago, they were largely associated with resources. So if you take a company like ExxonMobil, an oil company, it was the most valuable company in the US probably in the world 20 years ago, and now it's barely in the top 50, whereas the top companies are Google, so Alphabet owns Google, so Alphabet, Facebook, Apple and Microsoft and so forth. So that change has happened very radically, very rapidly. At the same time, neoliberalism is an ideology which arose in the late 20th century, part in response to a complicated history, and has really fallen over fairly thoroughly, particularly in the wake of the global financial crisis. Until the global financial crisis, the idea that the way we made our way to prosperity was to put all our affairs in the hands of financial markets. Now, the kind of bank economists I mentioned early on, that they would invest capital wisely and produce growing prosperity for everybody. Hardly anybody on either the right or the left really believes that. On the other hand, There is no well-worked-out solution sitting out there. That's why people are thinking about ideas like wellbeing economy, is there isn't a ready-made alternative waiting to be delivered.
John, what we've seen some debates around is into the 21st century and the 21st century economies, the financialization of information and also the financialization of services and the financialization of care. And in Australia, I guess we see some of that around the debates currently with aged care and where those kinds of care services have become for profit. What's your thinking on those kinds of trends that we've seen towards the financialization of things that it may be very difficult to put a financial value on or to make for profit?
Sure. Well, obviously, that's a central feature of neoliberalism and something which really became dominant particularly in the 1990s. Microeconomic reform, not using the word reform to mean change for the better, but what we saw was a notion that that the bureaucracies and not-for-profit agencies which had delivered these services were inefficient and bloated, and what we needed was more competition and choice for consumers. We recast people from being students and patients and these kinds of things to being customers. That if we had more, that what they wanted was more choice, and the way to give them more choice at lower costs was to have competition between providers. And we're seeing, I think, over the last decade in Australia, but also elsewhere, a pretty strong reaction against that, aged care being the most recent area. But before that, of course, we had a huge crisis in vocational education, which was a major disaster area. And we're seeing similar concerns about for-profit provision of childcare. So we're seeing, I think, an experiment which is already seen as failing by most people, even the defenders are saying, well, we can see there are big problems, but we're confident we can fix them up if we just have better regulation and so forth. So the kind of enthusiasm for financialisation, even in the policy elite, has diminished a lot, I think. On the other hand, the process so far has, of course, created some big and powerful influential interests who are defending their corner as vigorously as they can. And so reversing that process is proving very difficult.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. And it makes me wonder about the phrase rational economic behaviour. And so how much it underpins the sorts of economic policy decision-making we make and how important it is in that conversation we've just had about the role of the financialisation of the care environment.
A good question. I mean, rational can mean almost anything, and I could go on at great length about that. But certainly what it... the implications I've mentioned in these contexts is that consumers in the market will determine good outcomes rather than other rational principles, rational design, for example, which would say that what we want to do is work out the best way of doing this thing and do it. That's a different kind of rationality. The rationality of the market is to say, let's set prices on things and see how the market works things out. Now, both of those have their place. The market is a very powerful mechanism, so I don't want to run that down too much. But we are certainly seeing, I think, a retreat of the idea of markets as the arbiters of rationality.
How much is it assumed within that sort of a system that people have access to an equitable amount of information? There seems to be assumptions within that that consumers and markets make decisions that they're making it on the basis of good access to good information.
Yes, I mean, so information is I think, the big issue. And I think we're seeing from a relatively simple-minded version of the fact that we assume people have preferences and they know what they are and they'll just exercise them, to more sophisticated treatments of information, in particular the point that, of course, market participants have a pretty big incentive to put false information out there. And the majority of advertising is either uninformative or misinformative, and obviously that creates big problems if you have a model relying on market messages, including advertising, to drive consumer choice. So I think what we see is that there's been something of a retreat from that idea and acceptance that really the kinds of choices of services we've been talking about, that the idea that we can rely on the choice of well-informed consumers, I think, is being reevaluated.
Perhaps it is a good question for us to carry through in the series of conversations that we're planning here. It probably leads quite nicely then into a question about well-being and happiness. And you mentioned certainly that well-being is an important part of how your economic work is in an academic sphere. But how do we measure and how do we assess issues to do with human well-being and happiness within the dominant economic model?
The dominant economic model most of the time says, first, has a strong view of let people decide for themselves, which have already discussed. It works fairly well in the context of market choices. I think the question of, well, how do we assess people's happiness otherwise is one which economists have been grappling for a long time. I mean, there are a bunch of techniques that people use, essentially, roughly speaking, asking people and saying, well, would you rather have this or that? Would you rather have, for example, a tax cut or money spent on the environment? Those are the kinds of questions you can ask hypothetically, and of course they're also asked in political context, so that's another way of making those kinds of choices. There's quite a big body of literature which tries to assess happiness directly by asking people how happy are you on a scale of 0 to 10. I don't myself find that super appealing, but a lot of people have put a lot of work into it.
John, I'm interested to hear your thinking on those kinds of questions that ask people about their preferences or the trade-offs. So would you rather have a tax cut and more money in your pocket, or would you rather have money put into the environment? It always seems to me that we're putting people into almost impossible choice situations when we ask them to prioritise two things that they may feel are both critically important, or that they might not care less about, you know, depending on the individual. What does that kind of prioritisation give us in terms of information? Do you think that does give us useful information on which to gauge people's preferences or happiness, or is it somewhat flawed because it depends so much on the moment in time when that individual is asked?
Well, certainly I don't think it gives 100% reliable information. I think particularly when you're choosing between different bundles of attributes. So, you look at environmental preservation, an area I've worked on, you can work out whether people, for example, care about more national parks and open spaces or more threatened species. These are things that, in some sense, you can have different kinds of policies. One you sort of hand policy over to biodiversity experts and they preserve biodiversity, others will give you different kinds of stories. So I don't think any of this is reliable. I don't think there's any perfectly reliable mechanism. I mean, the historic thing has been it gets slugged out in the political sphere and ultimately that's going to be the solution. But certainly I think you can get some useful information from these kinds of exercises.
John, I think this might be a good point for us and our listeners to take a very short break. We will be back in just a moment to go a little deeper into some of these ideas, so don't go away.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Listeners, welcome back to this fabulous conversation that we are having with Professor John Quiggin. John, you have written and positioned yourself within a capability approach. This is a concept that will be familiar, I'm sure, to many of our listeners, but probably completely new to some. A capability approach is a way of thinking that became very influential in the last decades of the 20th century, led by the work of Professor Amartya Sen, and really starts to shift the paradigm in terms of what we value. We start to see growth as a means to an end, and we start to think much more about how we can ensure that people are able to make choices and to choose a life that they have reason to value. So, John, can I ask you how much a capability approach has really shifted our way of thinking, and how much it has influenced thinking around economics and the role of the economy in particular?
Well, I'm most familiar, and a lot of the use has been within the health sphere. And, of course, it's useful to start with the point that if you look at the business economists, the people we see on the TV that I mentioned, they're looking at GDP, and health status doesn't appear anywhere in GDP, because certainly not directly, because it's not part of what's traded in the market. It appears indirectly in the sense of if people are incapable of working, that reduces GDP, and of course health spending appears as part of GDP, but tends to be treated as a cost on the economy rather than as something which is essential to our well-being. So I'll put those groups aside to a moment and say, well, historically what the mainstream approach has been to look at this more or less in the way that you would look at a consumer good. So you could ask somebody, for example, we've got somebody with cataracts, for example, we've got this eye operation, it will give you better vision, but there's a certain risk that the operation might kill you. Do you think you'd like to go ahead with the operation or not? And from that, you can make an inference as to how much the improvement in quality of life from having better sight you'd value against the risk of an earlier death. And so that approach, based on what's called quality-adjusted life years, has had a big influence, and it's certainly come up, for example, in the context of the debate about what to do about the coronavirus pandemic. What capabilities approach says is, rather than looking at your health status as a sort of bundle of consumption, you look at the question, what can you do? And so... So, for example, rather than looking at the question of, to give a different example, how would you trade off a hip replacement against some other potential treatment that might extend your life, you look at the question, well, you want a hip replacement, why? In order that you can get from point A to point B. And so you look at the question, what are the functionings, the capabilities that are available to you? How do they relate to your capacity to take part in the society and so forth? And so you move away from this notion of a bundle of consumer goods to the question, well, what is the capabilities that those goods produce? And that is significantly determined, for example, by your interaction with society. And economists have sort of always known this. Back in the 18th century, Adam Smith was saying, well, you don't really need a linen shirt. That was what people had. But in our society, you'd be ashamed to go out without one, and therefore... you need that shirt in order to be able to walk the streets and not have people recognise you as somebody who is destitute. And so this idea that you value the good not intrinsic in itself, but for how it enables you to participate in society in your life, has a long history, but Sen is certainly the person who's developed it most.
It is a really interesting question, particularly in the health sphere, and I'm a cardiologist for my sins. In health economics, we think often about activity, and a lot of the economic drive in the health sphere, in our healthcare sector, is around doing things, and the functional focus is a more challenging way for us to look at the patient care outcome. But it really does have a tremendous amount of potential benefits, particularly in terms of quality of life. So translating, in fact, it's a really good example of translating it from a traditional economic model where growth and activity, consumptogenic activity particularly, or a consumptogenic system, is the mainstay of the financial underpinning of the health sector. Whereas the well-being approach might be, let's not generate that economic activity. Let's focus on the functional outcome from a person in their life. And so the economics of that dynamic can play out in an interesting way in a marketplace environment for healthcare.
Yes, that's right. I mean, obviously, the notion of focusing on economic activity gets problematic once you get outside the sphere where people are buying and selling goods on a regular basis. And so so fairly clearly, for example, if we get everybody getting fit, going out for morning walks and all the things they should do, and that means less heart surgeries, well, clearly that's a good thing, even though its implications for GDP, for market activity, well, they'll, of course, depend very much on how the society is organised. If you have a largely for-profit healthcare sector, then definitely people being healthier means them consuming less health services, there's less activity there. If you have a system where it's publicly funded and significantly rationed, then what that means is resources can be diverted from heart surgery to possibly other kinds of interventions which will yield more benefits in terms of health. So there's a clear benefit there.
That's a really interesting discussion. I think it'll be one we'll pick up later down the track in the series.
John, I think that's a really powerful example of thinking about how a capability approach may lead us to think a little differently about the place of human beings and where they fit in terms of demand for services and the market. But I'm wondering about the place of the environment and how thinking from a capability perspective might change the way we position the environment and may influence the way we deal with really crucial issues like the climate emergency that we're facing. Does a capability approach give us something there, give us a new way of thinking?
That's a good question. I mean, I haven't really thought about much before. And I mean, one of the features of a capability approach is it's essentially very human-centred. It may be, in fact, that that we can get more from a traditional mainstream economics point of view, which looks at notions of externalities, says, well, you know, it certainly gives you a very straightforward account of what we need to do about why we should reduce CO2 emissions, because essentially my emissions harm you and vice versa, and also gives us a fairly well-developed set of tools to deal with it. Which unfortunately have run into lots of political opposition from people who you would think ought to support markets. Although when you look at The Economist on the TV, it sounds as though the economy and the environment are in some sense opposed entities. In mainstream economics, the environment, sustaining the environment, is certainly a key part of welfare. And there's a very well-developed body of theory that says what we should do, in which economists have sadly had very little influence in actually getting that into the policy process.
I wonder whether the co-benefits for action on climate change, the sorts of things like improving active transport and changing nutrition, in fact, fits within a capability approach of economics, where we do see the individual health improve by acting on climate change.
Well, certainly there are co-benefits. I mean, you shouldn't always count them going the right way, I guess.
No.
For example, when we look at the pandemic, I mean, in many ways, something like remote working has co-benefits in terms of the environment, but on the other hand, the decline in use of public transport is going to be a major problem. So sometimes you get those co-benefits and sometimes not.
So this probably brings us on to work, which is another very interesting topic in this economic mix. You've argued, I think, for a universal basic income, and in fact, your recent policy statement from the Crawford School here on the livable income guarantee makes really interesting reading. Perhaps you could take us through the ideas behind that.
Well, I should say there's a bunch of ideas that come under this label, and they depend a lot on whether you focus on the universal part or the basic part. So, People that focus on the universal part say, let's just give everybody enough money to live on, and then we'll get it back from those who don't need it through the tax system. That's simple and appealing, but turns out to be much more difficult when you actually look at the implementation. People who focus on basic say, let's get rid of the obstacles that mean that significant numbers of people don't have enough to live on. And there's really a couple of components of that. One is raising existing benefits, like the unemployment benefit, which is currently Job Seeker but has had many different names, raising that to a level comparable to the old age pension, which is broadly speaking sufficient to live on. But the other is broadening the definition of the kinds of things that would allow you to get support from the public, so including voluntary work, artistic and creative activity, expanding eligibility for full-time students, a range of options which currently are subject to very strict and punitive regulation. So that's the version of the idea which Elise Klein and I and Tim Dunlop and others have put forward through the Crawford School. And it fits into a view that we haven't taken enough of the benefits of technological change, technological progress, in terms of increased freedom to pursue our own projects. So, for example, we haven't had a reduction in working hours, in standard working hours, for nearly 40 years, whereas for the previous century and a half, that was a major part of progress, was reducing standard working hours. We've seen the intensity of work fluctuate, but certainly in the 1990s and then again with the rise of the gig economy accelerating rather than diminishing, which was what we would expect. If we have better technology, we ought to be able to make work more pleasant and less stressful, but that's far from being the case, particularly in the context of the gig economy.
John, I wanted to ask you how we might think about not only basic income, recognising that income is fundamentally important. And I think back to the comment you made about Adam Smith's linen shirt and, you know, having sufficient income to live, to participate in society, as Peter Townsend would say, but also to kind of live a life with dignity where you're not in shame, living in shame and stigma, I think remains fundamentally important. And income is central to that. But I'm interested in your thinking about the provision of universal basic services in a 21st century context. And I'll preface this by saying I do a lot of work around multidimensional poverty, particularly in the global south. And what we see there often is that small increases in people's income will make a difference to their lives, but the poor quality of services that are available to the poor often mean that those small increases of income are not sufficient to change people's life prospects, and the quality of services that they are able to access remain very, very low. So I'm really keen to hear your thinking around the place of basic services, or perhaps universal basic services, that are of a high quality in current thinking about how we resolve problems of poverty and inequality?
Sure. Well, I think there's a complicated set of divisions, but basically the evidence has been that typically what we call human services, health, education, a whole range of related services are best provided on a universal access and not-for-profit basis. And we've seen, I think we've already discussed this a bit, but we've seen the failures of for-profit vision in these areas. Working out, and then we'll obviously want to get those at a quality which makes sense relative to the quality and abundance of private goods. And so, yeah, you can go back for one version of the imbalance to J.K. Galbraith, who talked about private affluence and public squalor, that if you don't fund those services adequately, you have a situation where people have a very high material standard of living but suffer from the inadequacy of a wide range of services. And certainly you could make the case that that's still very much the case in large parts of the United States today. There's no easy way of laying down the law, but I think that idea is clear. And the point about quality is important, that these are services in which we typically don't think, look, people have radically different consumer preferences. They basically want good quality healthcare, for example. I don't want a particular kind of healthcare. I want the best healthcare for my condition, and that I think is, and similarly with things like aged care, that our basic concern is getting a good quality of service, not in having a wide range of choice available to us. And that's very different from other things, even basic needs like food. Pretty clearly, in the case of food, I wouldn't want a government nutritionist saying, well, look, we've worked out what the best diet for you is and it'll be delivered to your door. I want to be able to go to the supermarket or go to the supermarket website and say, I'd like, these are the things I would like. And so that sphere in which consumer choice is important remains large. Roughly speaking, but not entirely, yeah, that maps into that division between goods and particularly human services.
Oh, that's a really great place for us to move into the last question for today's session. How optimistic are you that the coronavirus pandemic might give us a window for change? So we're in an extraordinary moment in time, a time where things that were previously not up for discussion and debate are on the table. And so if you think there is an opportunity, you know, window for change, what sorts of things would you like to see us achieve?
I have to admit I was optimistic in the first months of the pandemic, much, much less so now. I think the US election, which we've just seen, certainly indicates that catastrophic failure in the face of the pandemic doesn't carry a huge political price. And in the Australian context, we saw in the early months of the pandemic the Morrison government, which certainly had no obvious sign of any policy imagination, suddenly doing brave and unprecedented things. But it's now, our message now very much is, look, it's all over, let's get back to normal. It's hard to tell, of course, because very clearly things aren't back to normal, and the attempts by people to push it back that way have proved disastrously wrong. So we'll have to wait and see, I think, the extent to which how the crisis is resolved and how much it changes things. But I must admit, we haven't seen as much change as I would have hoped for from this shock. But I think there have been lots of lessons of things we can do. One thing it has done, I think, is open up the idea that things don't have to be the way they always have been, and that they're going to change radically in various ways, whether we like it or not.
No, I think that that's a really apt description of the landscape that we've seen in the political discussion of our economic response over the last 6 months, and the fluctuating levels of hope and distress that I think many of us are sharing. John Quiggin, thank you so much for your time today. It's been wonderful hearing your thoughts and having your expertise take us through a range of economic ideas and principles, both from the 20th and the 21st century. I think you've given us a really wonderful landscape of the things that might be up for discussion and debate over the next couple of series of discussions that Sharon and I are planning. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Anna Greta, what did you make of that?
That was a really fantastically helpful introduction, and in fact much more complex than an introduction. But for me, that helps to map this landscape of economic policy. I got a better understanding about how our markets work and the sorts of ways in which we make decisions. But I'm also really struck by some of the imaginative ideas that John Quiggin brings to the table about how we can reimagine the role that economic choice has in our society, and the ideas of changing particularly that dynamic of economic support from a government perspective and the way that that might translate to an improvement in our lives as individuals. How about you, Sharon? What did you get from this?
Yeah, I thought that was great. It was just such a great introduction for us, Anna Greta, as we think about this and explore these ideas, and hopefully for our listeners too. I guess as I'm listening to John, you know, I'm now starting to think, what are some of the gender implications of the things that John was saying? You know, so I think one of the things that we will take forward out of this as we talk to other experts on other issues is, you know, how do these issues impact differently perhaps on women and men? How do these issues impact differently on people across different stages of life? You know, and how do we, John made some interesting comments about the nature of work as well that I think lead us to some really deep thinking that's needed about the nature of work into the future, about issues of precarity, but how we provide people with greater security and greater meaning around their work. John also talked or made a really interesting comment about, you know, sort of 100 years ago, the focus was all on reducing hours of work, and that conversation seems to have been lost. So how do we reimagine work as we think about some of these big issues? So I am very excited.
Absolutely. So we want to talk about work. We're going to talk about gender. He made some amazing observations about this transition from a traditional resource-based economy through to an information economy. And I wonder if that has implications for things like climate change. If we're thinking about the consumption of goods, whether or not we might be able to imagine a world where our economic system is not around the consumption or the destruction of the natural environment. I was really fascinated by that and really very much interested to hear the way that we can reimagine our social structure around that.
I think that's right. And I guess for both of us, Anna Greta, we've been thinking about this series not just about mapping out all the terrible problems that the world is facing, and 2020 has not been the best year for most of the world, but how do we start to think about solutions? How do we start to think about ways forward, and how we really do think about this terrible moment in time as a way of thinking not about bouncing back and doing things as we did and repeating all the same mistakes that we've made in the past, but how we take this as an opportunity to think differently and to create a future that is more just, that is more equitable, and as you say, that doesn't destroy the planet. So I think that's where we will be going with our conversations over the next few weeks.
Absolutely. It's all about the human future, very much about the human future. So what shall we talk about on our next program? We've got a few different ideas that are in the mix here. What do you think we should do next?
Well, I'm thinking of you here, Anna Greta. There are a few things that I think we should talk about, but most of our conversations have been around issues of the environment and climate change. What do you say we start there?
I think that sounds like a great place to start. And let's see if we can take what we've learned from today, I certainly will be, and find a few people to talk about this with us and see if we can solve the problems of climate change by changing the economic system.
We can do that in an hour.
Easy.
So, listeners, come on this journey with us. We're going to keep these conversations going over the next few weeks. Please do reach out to us. And if you've got ideas of issues that you would like us to weave into this series, please let us know. You can contact us on Twitter at apps, policy forum, or by the old-fashioned email approach, podcast@policyforum.net. But the best way to get in touch with us and to stay in touch with us is to join our Facebook group. If you just type Policy Forum Pod into the search bar, you will find us there. And listeners, please don't forget to leave a review. You can subscribe to us through Acast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favourite podcasts from. So we will be back next week with another episode in this Wellbeing Economy series. Anna Greta, I'm really looking forward to taking this conversation forward then.
Absolutely. Sharon, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been wonderful spending time with you again. Looking forward to next week.
It has been fun. So I'll see you then, and listeners, join us next week.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.